It is the glazed inward stare of people who walk in their sleep. Oh, dear heaven, what do these unhappy children see that I do not? So the communal vision unfolds before them, and Mademoiselle dare not pierce the taut gossamer veil by a spoken word. They see the walls of the gymnasium fading in an exquisite transparency, the ceiling opening up like a flower into the brilliant sky above the hanging rock. The shadow of the rock is flowing, luminous as water, across the shimmering plain, and they are at the picnic, sitting on the warm, dry grass under the gum trees. Lunch is set out by the creek. They see the picnic basket, and another mademoiselle, gay, in a shady hat, is handing Miranda a knife to cut the heart-shaped cake. They see Marion Quaid with a sandwich in one hand and a pencil in the other, and Miss McCraw, forgetting to eat, propped against a tree in her puce pelisse. They hear Miranda proposing the health of St. Valentine, magpies and the tinkle of falling water. Another Irma, in white muslin, shaking out her curls and laughing at Miranda, washing out cups at the creek. Miranda, hatless, with shining yellow hair. A picnic was no fun without Miranda, always Miranda, coming and going in the dazzling light, like a rainbow. Oh, Miranda, Marion, where have you gone? The shadow of the rock has grown darker and longer. They sit, rooted to the ground, and cannot move. The dreadful shape is a living monster, lumbering towards them across the plain, scattering rocks and boulders. So near now, they can see the cracks and hollows where the lost girls lie rotting in a filthy cave. A junior, remembering how the Bible says the bodies of dead people are filled with crawling worms, is violently sick on the sawdust floor. Someone knocks over a wooden stool, and Edith screams out loud. Mademoiselle, recognizing the hyena call of hysteria, walks calmly to the edge of the dais with madly thumping heart.
Edith, stop that horrible noise. Blanche, Juliana, be silent. All of you, be silent.
Too late. The light voice of authority goes unheard as the smoldering passion long banked down under the weight of grey disciplines and secret fears bursts into flames. On the lid of the piano stood a small brass gong, normally struck for silence and order. Mademoiselle struck at it now, with all the force of her slender arm. The junior governess had retreated behind the music stool.
"It's no use, Mademoiselle. They won't take any notice of the gong or anything else. The class is quite out of hand."
"Try to get to the room by the side door without them seeing you and bring the head. This is serious."
The junior governess sneered.
"You're afraid, aren't you?"
"Yes, Miss Lumley. I am very much afraid."
Above a sea of thrusting heads and shoulders where Irma stood, hemmed in by the laughing, sobbing girls, a tuft of scarlet feathers trembled, rising and falling like a wounded bird. The voice of evil cackled as the tumult grew. Years later, when Madame Montpellier was telling her grandchildren the strange tale of panic in an Australian schoolroom,
50 years ago, mes enfants, but I dream of it still."
The scene had taken on the dimensions of a nightmare. Grandmère was no doubt confusing it with one of those villainous old prints of the French Revolution that had so terrified her as a little girl. She recalled for them the mad black bloomers, the instruments of torture in the gymnasium, the hysterical schoolgirls with faces distorted by passion, the streaming locks and claw-like hands. "Every moment," I thought, "they will lose control and tear her to pieces. Revenge. Senseless, cruel revenge. That is what they wanted. I can see it all now. Revenge on that beautiful little creature who was the innocent cause of so much suffering." Now, on a pleasant March afternoon, in the year 1900, it was a hideous reality to be faced and somehow dealt with single-handed by the young French governess, Diane de Poitiers. Gathering up her wide silk skirts, she took a flying leap from the dais and was hurrying towards the milling group when something warned her to walk sedately, with head held high. Meanwhile, Irma, limp and utterly bewildered, was near suffocation. Fastidious Irma, who deplored all female odours and protested that she could smell Miss Lumley's peppermint-laden presence in the classroom 6 feet away, was inexplicably hemmed in by angry faces, enlarged in hateful proximity to her own. Fanny's little snub nose, hugely out of focus and sniffing like a terrier with an exposure of bristling hairs, a cavernous mouth agape on a gold-stopped tooth that must be Juliana, the moist tip of a drooling tongue. Their warm, sour breath came and went on her cheeks, heated bodies pressed on her sensitive breasts. She cried out in fear and tried in vain to push them away. A disembodied moon face rose up somewhere in the background.
"Edith! You!"
"Yes, Ducky, it's me."
In the novel role of ringleader, Edith was beside herself, smugly wagging a stumpy forefinger.
"Come on, Irma. Tell us. We've waited long enough."
There was a nudging and muttering. "Edith's right. Tell us, Irma. Tell us."
"What can I tell you? Have you all gone crazy?" "The hanging rock," Edith said, pushing to the front. "We want you to tell us what happened up there to Miranda and Marion Quaid."
The more silent of the New Zealand sisters, rarely articulate, added loudly,
"Nobody in this rat hole ever tells us anything."
Other voices joined in.
"Miranda, Marion Quaid, where are they? I can't tell you, I don't know."
Suddenly, possessed of a power that drove her slim body between the closed ranks like a wedge, Mademoiselle was standing beside her, holding Irma's arm. She cried in her little light French voice,
"Imbeciles! Have you no brains, no heart? How can la pauvre Irma tell us something she does not know?"
"She knows all right, only she won't tell."
Blanche's doll face was an angry red under the tousled curls. "Irma likes to have grown-up secrets. She always did." Edith's great head was nodding like a mandarin's.
"Then I'll tell you if she won't. Listen, all of you. They're dead. Dead. Miranda and Marion and Miss McCraw, all dead as doornails in a nasty old cave full of bats on the hanging rock.
Edith Hutton, you are a liar and a fool.
Mademoiselle's hand had come down smartly on Edith's cheek.
Holy Mother of God.
The Frenchwoman was praying out loud. Rosamond, who had taken no part in all this, was praying too. To Saint Valentine. He was the only saint she was acquainted with, and so, quite rightly, she prayed to him. Miranda had loved Saint Valentine. Miranda believed in the power of love over everything.
Saint Valentine, I don't know how to pray to you properly. Dear Saint Valentine, make them leave Irma alone and love one another for Miranda's sake.
Not often, surely, is the good Saint Valentine traditionally concerned with the lesser frivolities of romantic love, offered a prayer of such innocent urgency. But it seems only fair that he should be credited with its speedy and practical answer. A smiling messenger from heaven in the guise of Irish Tom. Open-mouthed and gloriously solid and masculine at the gymnasium door. Dear kindly toothless Tom, fresh from a visit to the dentist at Woodend and overjoyed, despite his aching jaws, to see the poor young creatures having a bit of a lark for once in a way. Tom, grinning respectfully at Mademoiselle and waiting for a suitable interlude into the larks, whatever they can be, to ease off, so that he can deliver Ben Hussey's message to Miss Irma. The arrival of Tom caused a moment of distraction and turning of heads, in which Irma shook herself free. Rosamond rose from her knees. Edith pressed a hand to her burning cheek. The messenger presented Mr. Hussey's compliments, and if Miss Leopold was set on catching the Melbourne Express, she had best come this minute, adding, as a personal postscript, "And good luck to you, miss, from myself and all in the kitchen." It was all over. As simply and quickly as that, with the girls falling back in the old orderly manner to let Irma pass between them, and Mademoiselle kissing her lightly on the cheek.
"You will find your parasol hanging up in the hall, ma chérie. Au revoir. We shall meet again."
Ah, but never, never again, my little dove. There was a perfunctory murmuring of farewell as they watched her, walking with the old remembered grace towards the gymnasium door. Here, filled with an infinite compassion for sorrows unguessed at and forever unexplained, she turned, waved a little gloved hand, and wanly smiled. So Irma Leopold passed from Appleyard College and out of their lives. Mademoiselle was consulting her watch.
"We are late this afternoon, girls."
The gymnasium, always poorly lit, was rapidly darkening.
"Go at once to your rooms and change those ugly bloomers to something pretty for supper tonight."
"Can I wear my pink?"
Edith wanted to know. The governess looked up sharply.
"You may wear what you like."
Only Rosamond lingered.
"Shall I help you tidy the room, mademoiselle?"
"No. Thank you, Rosamond. I have a migraine and would like to be alone for a little while."
The door closed on the empty room. It was only now that she remembered that Dora Lumley had never come back with the head. It is no easy matter to emerge with dignity from a crouching position in a narrow cupboard with one eye glued to the keyhole. Something pretty indeed. Dora Lumley, who now thought it prudent to step out from safe asylum, could hardly believe her ears.
So, the brave little toad has come out of its hole.
A trickle of saliva moistened Dora Lumley's dry lips.
You are insolent, mademoiselle.
Diane, meticulously putting away her music, tossed the junior governess a contemptuous glance.
I might have guessed. You made no attempt to give my message to the head.
It was too late. Somebody would have seen me. It seemed better to stay here until it was over.
In the cupboard? Oh, the wise little toad.
Well, why not? The girls were making a disgraceful exhibition of themselves. There was nothing I could do.
You had better do something now and help me put some order into this horrible room. I don't wish that the servants notice anything unusual tomorrow morning.
The point is, mademoiselle, what are we going to tell Mrs. Appleyard?
Nothing.
Nothing?
You heard me? Exactly nothing.
You astound me. If I had my way, they should be whipped.
There is a word in the French language that fits you à merveille. Dora Lumley, malheureusement. Decent people do not use it.
The sallow cheeks flushed.
How dare you speak to me like that? How dare you? I shall inform Mrs. Appleyard myself of these disgraceful goings-on this very night.
Diane de Poitiers had picked up an Indian club from the floor.
You see this? I have the wrists exceptionally strong, Miss Lumley. Unless you give me a promise before you leave this room that you will not tell one little word of what happens here this afternoon, I will hit you with it. Very hard indeed. And nobody would suspect the French governess. You understand what I say?
You are not fit to be in authority over innocent young girls.
I agree. I was brought up expecting something much more entertaining. Alors, c'est la vie. You promise?
Dora Lumley, looking desperately towards the closed door, decided the necessary dash was too much for her fallen arches and heaving chest. The Frenchwoman was idly twirling the Indian club.
I am perfectly serious, Miss Lumley, though I don't intend to give you my reasons.
I promise, gasped the other, now trembling and marble-white as Mademoiselle calmly replaced the club on top of the pile.
Mercy on us! What's that strange sound?
From the far corner of the room, now almost in darkness, came a single rasping cry. Miss Lumley, under the stress of a most unpleasant afternoon, had forgotten to unfasten the leather straps that held the child, Sarah, rigid on the horizontal board. 13. Whether the events just related were eventually made known to Mrs. Appleyard can only be surmised. It is unlikely, under the circumstances, that Dora Lumley broke her promise of silence to Mademoiselle. At supper that evening, over which the headmistress presided as she occasionally liked to do, the boarders were quiet and orderly, if not particularly hungry. A little desultory conversation was indulged in, and, to all appearances, as far as Diane de Poitiers could judge, nothing special was amiss, apart from Sarah Wayborn's absence with a migraine, and Edith Horton complaining to Miss Lumley of a touch of neuralgia in the right cheek. Edith supposed she must have been sitting in a draught in the gymnasium.
"The gymnasium can be a very draughty room," put in Mademoiselle from her end of the table.
The headmistress, gloomily attacking a lamb cutlet at the opposite end, might have been engaged in expertly dismembering a man-eating shark. Actually, she had far more important fish to fry. The cutlet being no more than an outward symbol of inner conflict concerning the two letters, one from Mr. Leopold and one from Miranda's father, still unanswered on her desk. However, she felt it was necessary for purposes of morale to keep the conversational ball rolling and forced herself to inquire of Rosamond, on her right hand, whether Irma Leopold was travelling to England by the Orient or P&O line.
"I don't know, Mrs. Appleyard. Irma stayed such a very short while this afternoon. We hardly spoke to her.
My sister and I thought she looked rather pale and tired," piped up the more articulate of the New Zealand pair.
"Indeed. Irma assured me herself she is in perfect health."
The gold padlock on the head's heavy chain bracelet rattled against her plate. She felt herself start, and fancied that the French governess at the other end of the table was looking at her in rather a peculiar way, noted the emeralds sparkling on her wrist, and wondered if they were too large to be real. The sight of the jewels brought her thoughts back to the Leopolds, said to own a diamond mine in Brazil. She made a vicious stab at the cutlet and decided to sit up all night if necessary and get Tom to post both letters by the early mail on Friday morning. Directly, the meal was over and the Lord duly thanked for rice pudding and stewed plums, the headmistress rose from the table, retired to the study, locked the door, and sat down, pen in hand, to her odious task. Most women faced with a situation so dangerous, so entangled by a thousand side issues, would long ago have taken the simplest way out. It would still have been possible, for instance, to plead urgent business in England and regrettably close down the college for good, even to sell it for what it would bring while it remained a going concern. What was it called in business? Goodwill. She ground her teeth. Precious little of that. The college was already being talked about as haunted, and God knows what other mischievous nonsense. She might sit in her study behind closed doors for the better part of the day, but she had eyes in her head and ears. Only yesterday, Cook had mentioned quite casually to Minnie that they were saying in the village that strange lights had been seen moving about in the college grounds after dark. In the past, Mrs. Appleyard and her Arthur had skated hand in hand over some remarkably thin ice, but never before had they been confronted by a situation impregnated with such personal and public disaster. To take a sword and plunge it through your enemy's vitals in broad daylight is a matter of physical courage, whereas the strangling of an invisible foe in the dark calls for other qualities. Tonight, her whole being cried out for decisive action. Yes. But what kind of action? Not even Arthur could have worked out a plan of campaign while the damnable mystery at the Hanging Rock remained unsolved. Before settling down to either of the letters for the second time that day, she took the ledger from the bottom drawer and studied it closely. On present calculations, it seemed probable that only about 9 of the former 20 pupils would be expected to return when the new term began after Easter. Once again, she ran down the list of names. The last to be crossed off was Horton, Edith, whose insufferably stupid mother had written only today announcing other plans for her only daughter. A few months ago, the news would have been only too welcome, and the school dunce easily replaced. Without Edith, only 9 other names were left, including Sarah Wayborn. There was a bottle of cognac in the cupboard behind the desk. She unlocked it and half-filled the glass. The thread of fiery spirit touched off a train of clear, factual thinking. She sat down at the desk again and made a few notes in the impersonal copperplate hand that gave away nothing of the background character and iron will of the woman who held the pen. It was nearly 3 o'clock when at last the letters were stamped and sealed and the headmistress dragged her weary body upstairs. The following day passed without incident. There was a note in the post from Constable Bumper saying he had nothing fresh to report, but one of the Russell Street men would like to see Mrs. Appleyard sometime next week when convenient. There were 1 or 2 points concerning matters of school discipline prior to the day of the picnic, which some of the parents had suggested should be elucidated. The weather was mild and fine, and Mr. Whitehead had requested a long-deferred day off, which he passed in reading the horticultural news with his boots off. Tom went about his duty with his raging jaws tied up in a strip of Minnie's flannel petticoat, and Sarah Wayborn, on special instructions from Mademoiselle, spent most of the day in bed. Otherwise, all was usual. Saturday was usually a day taken up with small domesticities and household tasks. The boarders did their mending, wrote their letters home, their correspondence rigorously censored at headquarters with the aid of a spirit lamp on the desk, played croquet or lawn tennis in fine weather, or wandered aimlessly about the grounds. Tom was making heavy weather of a chat with Miss Buck beside the dahlia bed when the arrival of Hussey's cab at the front door set him free. There was no luggage to be taken off, however, only a seedy-looking young man of about his own age carrying a small seedy-looking bag who asked the driver to wait out of sight of the front windows until further instructions. Insignificant as he was in appearance, Tom at once recognized Miss Lumley's cocky little squirt of a brother. It was the first time for several months that Reg Lumley had paid his sister a visit at the college. Why, in the name of heaven, had he chosen today? Thought the headmistress, watching him pulling on a pair of gloves and smoothing down a shabby overcoat, preparatory to ringing the doorbell. Mrs. Appleyard, who secretly prided herself on being able to get rid of an unwelcome visitor within 3 minutes, if necessary, with all graciousness, had recognized Reg at the very first handshake as a sticker and stayer. In short, like his sister Dora, a fool and a bore. However, here he was, or rather, He's not very clean card with his business address in the township of Warrigal.
You may show Mr. Lumley in, Alice, and tell him I am very much occupied.
Reg Lumley, dank, pompous, and half-baked, was a clerk in the Gippsland store, holding views and opinions on every subject under the sun, from female education to the incompetence of the local fire brigade. Which of them, thought the headmistress, drumming impatient fingers on the desk, was he going to bring out today? And what could have brought him all this way from Warrigal without warning?
"Good morning, Miss Lumley. I wish you had thought to write and tell us you intended calling today. I happen to be extremely busy this afternoon, and so is your sister. Put your hat down on that chair, if it's worrying you, and your umbrella."
Reg, who had lain awake half the preceding night, picturing himself delivering his ultimatum from a vertical position of authority, reluctantly seated himself on a chair with his umbrella between his knees.
"I may say I had no intention of calling today, ma'am, until I received a telegram from my sister Dora late yesterday afternoon. It upset me considerably."
"Indeed. May I ask why?"
"Because it confirmed my own opinion that Appleyard College is no longer a suitable place for my sister to be employed."
"I am not concerned with matters of purely personal opinion. Have you any reason for this extraordinary statement?"
"Yes, I have. A number of reasons, in fact."
He was fumbling in his shiny pockets.
"I have a letter here, in case you are not in, you know. Shall I read it to you?"
"Thank you. No."
She looked up at the clock over her shoulder.
"If you can tell me what you have to say as briefly as possible." "Well, to begin with, it's all this publicity concerning the college. In my opinion, there has been far too much publicity ever since these unfortunate occurrences at the Hanging Rock."
The headmistress said acidly,
"I don't recall your sister being mentioned at any time in the press." "Well, perhaps not my sister, but you know how people talk. You can't open a paper nowadays without reading something about all this business. It's not right, in my view, that a respectable young woman like Dora should be connected in any way whatsoever with crime and all that sort of thing."
If young Lumley's heart could have been exposed to view like the poet's, it would have had graven upon it respectability. Publicity was hardly ever respectable in Reg's opinion, unless you were somebody frightfully important, like Lord Kitchener.
"Be careful how you express yourself, Mr. Lumley. Not crime. Mystery, if you like. A very different matter."
"All right, then. Mystery. And I don't like it, Mrs. Appleyard, and nor does my sister."
"My solicitors are confident there will be a solution shortly, whatever you and your friends in Warrigal may choose to think."
"Is that all you have to say?"
"Only that Dora has told me she wishes to terminate her employment with you, as from today, Saturday, March the 21st. In point of fact,
I have a cab outside waiting to take her away. And if you will kindly tell her her brother is here and have her pack her bags, the heavy luggage can be sent on later. At this juncture, as he later remarked to his sister in the train, the young man had noticed a strange mottled colour creeping up Mrs. Appleyard's neck under the net collar. Her eyes, which she had never looked at before one way or the other, had gone round like a couple of marbles and appeared to be jumping out of her head. The next minute, the old girl had let fly.
"Phew! Dora, I wish you'd heard her. Luckily, I had complete control of the situation and didn't attempt to answer back."
An impartial witness might have observed that the visitor himself had gone a curious shade of waxen green and was visibly trembling.
"Your sister is a pink-eyed imbecile, Mr. Lumley. I should have given her notice before Easter, even without your interference. Fortunately, you have saved me the trouble. You understand, of course, that by her extraordinary behaviour she forfeits her salary for such a breach of contract." "I'm not so sure about that. However, that can be adjusted later. And, by the way, I understand she would like a written reference." "I dare say she would, although any reference from myself with a grain of truth in it would be unlikely to gain her a position."
Her hand struck the blotting pad with such force that it nearly jumped off the desk, at which Mr. Lumley jumped too.
"I am a truthful woman, Mr. Lumley, and if you don't know it already, allow me to tell you that your sister is a bad-tempered, ignorant dunce, and the sooner she gets out of this house, the better."
She pulled the bell rope at her elbow, rose from the desk.
"If you will kindly wait in the hall, one of the maids will bring your sister, and you may tell her to start packing her bags at once. If she hurries, you can catch the Melbourne Express." "But, Mrs. Appleyard, I insist on you hearing me out. Surely you want to know my point of view about all this? I mean, there are quite a number of people who..."
The door of the study was somehow behind him. Hatless and trembling with suppressed fury, Reg stood alone in the hall. Here, in an agony of frustrated oratory and punctured self-esteem, he was obliged to pass the time as best he could, on a high-backed mahogany chair, devising ways and means of retrieving his hat from the study without loss of face. Within an hour, Dora Lumley had succeeded in compressing her meagre stock of clothing and few personal possessions, a Japanese fan, a birthday book, her mother's garnet ring, into a wicker dress basket, several bags and brown paper parcels, and was seated beside her brother in Hussey's cab. It is hardly necessary to add that the cab bowled down the drive under the scrutiny of numerous pairs of unseen eyes. Curiosity has its own peculiar means of expression, the spoken word assisted by raised eyebrows, nods, head shakings, and the shrugging of shoulders. On the evening of Saturday the 21st, curiosity at Appleyard College was at fever heat. Despite the restrictive rules of silence, a highly sensitized ear would have been aware of a ceaseless gnat-like buzzing on stairs and landings, the wordless hum of female curiosity, aroused but as yet unsatisfied. Ever since Miss Lumley and her brother had been seen driving away together late in the afternoon, the weird assortment of hastily packed belongings on the seat had given rise to the wildest speculation. Was the junior governess actually leaving the college for good? And if so, why such haste? It was generally agreed that it was unlike Miss Lumley to miss a chance of a spectacular farewell. The housemaid was implored to repeat what the brother had said on arrival and how long he was left stranded in the hall. And what Miss Lumley had said when informed by Alice that her brother was waiting below with a cab. All very mysterious, and in its way serving as comic relief in an otherwise colourless day. Dora Lumley and her impossible brother having been long ago pigeonholed as figures of fun. The only member of the household to show no interest in Miss Lumley's departure was Sarah Wayborn, who had passed the afternoon in wandering about the grounds with a book. Struck by the child's increasing pallor, Mademoiselle made up her mind to take the bull by the tail and ask Mrs. Appleyard to send for Dr. Mackenzie. Ever since the scene in the gymnasium, Diane had been conscious of a strange new strength. She was no longer afraid of Mrs. Appleyard's individual wrath, now rendered impotent by the impersonal wrath of heaven. There were only 5 more days left until Wednesday, when the college broke up for the Easter vacation. After that, Appleyard College would be little more than a bad dream as she lay in her Louis's arms. Rosamond, glancing across the supper table, saw her sudden smile above the plate of Irish stew and rightly guessed her thoughts. Life at the college without Mamselle's endearing presence would be insupportable. She thought, "Why am I here, with all these stupid children?" and decided to ask her parents to let her go home for good at Easter. Not only Sarah Wayborn, but Mrs. Appleyard was in need of Dr. Mackenzie's attention. She had lost a great deal of weight in the past few weeks, and the full silk skirts hung loosely about her massive hips. The flaccid cheeks were sometimes pale and sunken, sometimes mottled a dull red and blown up, as Blanche whispered to Edith, like a fish left too long in the sun. The two girls giggled in the shadows of Aphrodite, watching their headmistress slowly mounting the staircase from the hall. Halfway towards the first landing, the headmistress caught sight of Minnie coming up from the back stairs with a tray, nicely set out with a lace-trimmed cloth and Japanese china. She inquired acidly, "Have we an invalid in the house?" Minnie, unlike Cook and Alice, was never intimidated by Mrs. Appleyard. "It's Miss Sarah's supper, ma'am. Mamselle asked me to slip up with something, seeing there's no homework for the young ladies of a Saturday night, and the child's feeling poorly." The girl had just reached the door of Sarah's room when Mrs. Appleyard, retiring early to her vast bedroom directly above the study, called her back.
"Kindly tell Miss Sarah not to put out her light until she has had a word with me."
Sarah was sitting up in bed, with the gas turned very low, her heavy hair unbraided and falling about her narrow shoulders, and looking, Minnie thought, almost pretty, thanks to a fevered flush and dark glittering eyes. "See, miss, I bought you a nice boiled egg on Mamselle's special orders. The jelly and cream is something I pinched for you meself off Madame's dinner tray." A thin arm shot out from under the coverlet.
"Take it away. I won't touch it."
Now then, Miss Sarah, that's real baby talk. A great girl of 13, isn't that right?
I don't know. Even my guardian doesn't know for certain. Sometimes I feel as if I was hundreds of years old.
You won't feel that way when you leave school, and all the boys are after you, miss. All you need is a bit of fun.
Fun? Repeated the child. Fun! Come over here, close to the bed, and I'll tell you something nobody at the college knows except Miranda, and she promised never, never to tell.
Minnie, I was brought up in an orphanage.
Fun!
Sometimes I dream about it even now, when I can't go to sleep. One day I told them I thought it would be fun to be a lady circus rider on a lovely white horse in a spangled dress. The matron was afraid I was going to run away and shaved my head. I bit her in the arm.
There, miss, don't cry.
The kind-hearted Minnie was horribly embarrassed.
Look, lovely, I'll leave the tray here on the washstand in case you change your mind. Look, that reminds me.
Madam said to tell you not to turn out your light till she comes in to see you.
Sure you won't try a bit of the jelly?
Never. Not if I was starving. She turned her face to the wall. In the second-class compartment of the Melbourne train, Reg and Dora Lumley had talked without ceasing, the sister now and then dabbing at angry tears with interjections of,
"Monstrous! Oh, surely not! You don't say! How dare she!"
as the wayside stations flew past in the gathering dusk. Already the brother was planning ways and means of extracting the full term's salary, in Reg's opinion, a matter of extreme urgency.
Why, Dora, for all we know, the old girl may be bankrupt any day, or getting that way.
When the train drew in at Spencer Street Station, it had been decided that Dora would accompany her brother back to Warrigal, there to housekeep for three in the dilapidated cottage of an aging aunt.
In my opinion, Dora, you might do a great deal worse. After all, Aunt Lydia cannot live forever.
On which inspiring note, they stepped out of the train and boarded a tram to a respectable small hotel in a respectable city street. Dora was filled with admiration for her strong-minded, capable brother, who had even engaged beforehand two cheap single rooms for the night in the back wing. They were just in time for a late evening meal, and after swallowing some cold mutton and strong tea, the brother and sister retired, exhausted, to bed. About 3 o'clock in the morning, an oil lamp, left alight too close to a blowing curtain on the wooden stairs, fell to the floor. The flames began licking up the shabby wallpaper and blistered paintwork. Curls of smoke poured unseen into the street from the staircase window. Within minutes, the whole of the back wing was a roaring vault of fire. 14. Reg Lumley's final exit, although perfectly respectable, was accompanied by such lurid flames of publicity that in death the young man took on an almost phoenix-like quality of colourful resurrection from the burning hotel. The Warrigal store, where for 15 insignificant years he had worked and argued and held forth, was closed for half a day on the occasion of the Lumleys' funeral, a public tribute that might or might not have been appreciated by the deceased, at last unable to voice his opinions. In the previous chapter, we witnessed a segment of the pattern begun at Hanging Rock, literally burning itself out, 5 weeks later in a city hotel. During the weekend of the fire, yet another was gradually coming to a freezing standstill amongst the mountain mists at Lakeview. Mike had been nearly a week in town, and the Fitzhuberts had returned to Toorak for the winter, when a solicitor's letter, mislaid, had obliged him to spend a couple of nights at Mount Macedon. Albert had met him at the Macedon station with the cob on the evening of Saturday the 21st. Actually, his train passed within inches of the Lumleys en route for Melbourne. As the dog-cart passed under the now leafless avenue of Chestnut, it had begun, almost imperceptibly, to sleet.
"Winter's coming up early this year, all right," Albert said, turning up his collar. "Don't wonder all the nobs can afford to clears out for the winter."
There are only a few lights burning in the usually brilliantly lit facade of the house.
Cook hasn't left for her holiday yet, but the biddies have gone out with the family to Toorak. Your old room's ready and a fire laid.
He grinned.
You know how to light a wood fire.
A single light burned dimly in the hall, and through the open door of the drawing room, they glimpsed the shrouded sofas and chairs.
Not too lively up here, is it? Better eat your dinner and come on down to me at the stables. I got a bottle of grog the Colonel gave me the day he left.
Mike, however, was tired and dispirited and promised to come tomorrow. The Lakeview house, emptied of the day-to-day presence of its owners, was dull and lifeless. It existed only as a comfortable holiday background for his aunt and uncle, and had no personality of its own. Michael, eating his chop on a tray by the fire, was dimly conscious of the difference between Lakeview and Haddingham Hall, whose ivy walls had existed and would go on existing for hundreds of years, dominating the lives of succeeding generations of Fitzhuberts, who had at times gone as far as to fight and die for the survival of its Norman tower. Next morning, the solicitor's letter turned up exactly where Mike had expected, stuffed into the back of the little drawer in the spare room writing table. It was Sunday, and as Albert had a mysterious appointment concerning a horse on an outlying farm, he passed the greater part of the day in wandering aimlessly about the grounds. About midday, the wreathing mists lifted to show a clear view of the pine forests against the pale blue sky. After lunch, when the sun came out in fitful primrose gleams, he strolled down to the lodge and was met with open arms by the cutlers and regaled with hot scones and tea in the cosy kitchen.
"And how's Miss Irma? My, you wouldn't guess how we miss her about the place."
Mike confessed that he hadn't seen her while he was in town, but understood she was sailing for England on Tuesday, at which Mrs. Cutler's face fell in genuine consternation. As soon as the visitor left, Mr. Cutler, who, like most people who live in close daily contact with nature, was aware of elemental rhythms, said mildly,
"I always reckoned there was something between them two. Pity." His wife sighed. "I couldn't believe my ears when he spoke so casual-like about my poor dear lamb."
At twilight, Mike had gone down to the lake, where the dry rattle of the reeds and bare willow streamers dipping in and out of the little cove, in summer a shaded anchorage for the punt, filled him with a restless melancholy.
The swans had disappeared, and the water lilies, whose dark green pads dotted the black sunless surface. The oak, where he had seen the swan drinking at the clamshell on a summer's afternoon, was naked to the sky. In the distance he could hear the little stream tumbling down from the forest under the rustic bridge. The tinkling music seemed to accentuate the stillness and silence of the interminable day.
As soon as he had finished his evening meal, he took the hurricane lamp that was always hung in the side passage and made his way, in drizzling sleet, to the stable. There was a light in the window of Albert's room, and the trapdoor propped open with a boot for the reception of the visitor. On the table a bottle of whiskey and two glasses were set out.
"Sorry I can't make a fire up here, no chimney, but the grog keeps the cold out and cook knocked us up a sandwich. Help yourself."
Mike thought there was an air of welcome, even of comfort, unknown in his aunt's drawing room.
"If you were a married man," he said, settling down into the broken rocking chair, "you would be what the women's magazines call a homemaker." "I like a bit of comfort when I can get it, if that's what you mean."
"Not only that." Like so many things one would have liked to say, it was too complicated to embark on.
"I'd like to see you in a place of your own some day." "Oh, you would, wouldn't you? I'd soon be getting itchy feet, Mike, even if I had the dough to settle down and raise a pack of kids. How you liking city life with the knobs?"
"Not at all. My aunt can think of nothing but giving one of her ghastly parties for me. I haven't told them yet. I'm going up north in a week or two, probably Queensland."
"Now there's a place I've never really seen, except the Brisbane waterfront and the lock-up at Toowoomba. Oh, only for one night. I told you before, I was with a pretty tough mob in them days."
Mike glanced affectionately at the brick-red features, more honest in the flickering candlelight than the faces of many of his Cambridge friends, who let their tailor's bills run on for years and had never passed a night behind bars.
"Why not take a holiday and come up north with me?"
"Jeez, you mean that?"
"Of course I mean it. Where would you be stopping?"
"There's a big cattle station I want to see, way up near the border. It's called Goonawingi." Albert said thoughtfully, "I reckon I could easily get a job on one of them big runs. All the same, Mike, I can't walk out on your uncle and the horses unless I got someone to suit him at Lake View.
The old bastard's treated me pretty good, taking it all around."
"I understand that," Mike said. "Anyway, start keeping your eyes skinned for the right bloke to take over, and I'll write to you as soon as I know my plans." Money was noticeably not mentioned. At this stage, the offer of a train fare to Queensland would have been out of keeping with the dignity of a perfect understanding. The stuffy little room was almost cozy, what with the whiskey and the light of the two candles. Mike helped himself to another drink and felt the gentle glow running through his veins. "When I was a child, I always thought whiskey was some kind of remedy for toothache. My nanny used to dip cotton wool into the bottle."
Lately I find stiff whiskies quite a help when I can't sleep.
Still thinking about that bloody rock.
I can't help it. It comes back at night. Dreams.
Talk about dreams.